From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. Ronald Reagan did not appear in public for the last 10 years of his life. Confined by Alzheimer's disease and age, the 40th president of the United States, a man who thrived for more than half a century of public life on connecting with audiences, lived privately under the watchful eye of his devoted wife Nancy behind the gates at their home in the luxurious hills above Los Angeles. Through his long film career, his political life, first as governor of California and then for 8 years as president, Ronald Reagan communicated. He wanted to be remembered as the great communicator, and that likely is Ronald Reagan's greatest legacy, as a man who used his physical presence, his good looks, and his fine baritone to convey the force of his convictions. Just as President Franklin D. Roosevelt mastered the radio airwaves with fireside chats from the White House, Ronald Reagan mastered the imagery of television as the medium for his message. In one of the most poignant and well-scripted performances of his presidency, 20 years ago today, Ronald Reagan stood on the shores of Normandy before an audience of veterans who had risked their lives on those beaches. With cameras positioned to set him off against a backdrop of sandy cliffs, the great communicator spoke at the U.S. Ranger Monument at Pointe-du-Hoc, France.
For 4 long years, much of Europe had been under a terrible shadow. Free nations had fallen. Jews cried out in the camps. Millions cried out for liberation. Europe was enslaved and the world prayed for its rescue. Here in Normandy, the rescue began. Here the Allies stood and fought against tyranny in a giant undertaking unparalleled in human history. We stand on a lonely, windswept point on the northern shore of France. The air is soft, but 40 years ago at this moment, the air was dense with smoke and the cries of men, and the air was filled with the crack of rifle fire and the roar of cannon.
Ronald Reagan verbally turned with ease from poetically evoking the great issues of World War II to the individual heroism that marked D-Day.
At dawn on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion: to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns. The Allies had been told that some of the mightiest of these guns were here, and they would be trained on the beaches to stop the Allied advance. The Rangers looked up and saw the enemy soldiers at the edge of the cliffs shooting down at them with machine guns and throwing grenades, and the American Rangers began to climb. They shot rope ladders over the face of these cliffs and began to pull themselves up. When one Ranger fell, another would take his place. When one rope was cut, a Ranger would grab another and begin his climb again. They climbed, shot back, and held their footing. Soon, one by one, the Rangers pulled themselves over the top, and in seizing the firm land at the top of these cliffs, they began to seize back the continent of Europe. 225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. Behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Pointe-du-Hoc.
The finely crafted prose that Ronald Reagan so eloquently delivered touched on consistent themes and carried familiar messages, core values that were woven into the fabric of his presidency. Anti-communism was frequently heard when he spoke at historic moments. Here, still at Normandy, President Reagan linked the conflict of the past to the great international struggle the United States faced in the decades following World War II.
In spite of our great efforts and successes, not all that followed the end of the war was happy or planned. Some liberated countries were lost. The great sadness of this loss echoes down to our own time in the streets of Warsaw, Prague, and East Berlin. The Soviet troops that came to the center of this continent did not leave when peace came. They're still there, uninvited, unwanted, unyielding, almost 40 years after the war. Because of this, Allied forces still stand on this continent. Today, As 40 years ago, our armies are here for only one purpose, to protect and defend democracy. The only territories we hold are memorials like this one and graveyards where our heroes rest. We in America have learned bitter lessons from two world wars. It is better to be here ready to protect the peace than to take blind shelter across the sea, rushing to respond only after freedom is lost. We've learned that isolationism never was and never will be an acceptable response to tyrannical governments with an expansionist intent. But we try always to be prepared for peace, prepared to deter aggression, prepared to negotiate the reduction of arms, and yes, prepared to reach out again in the spirit of reconciliation. In truth, there is no reconciliation we would welcome more than a reconciliation with the Soviet Union, so together we can lessen the risk of war now and forever.
President Reagan was often oratorically strongest on those occasions when the nation faced its most somber moments. And as his speechwriters provided flowing, simple verse, Mr. Reagan complimented the words with comforting tones. On January 28, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded as it climbed to leave the Earth's atmosphere. Mr. Reagan spoke on television that evening from the Oval Office.
19 years ago, almost to the day, we lost three astronauts in a terrible accident on the ground. But we've never lost an astronaut in flight. We've never had a tragedy like this. And perhaps we've forgotten the courage it took for the crew of the shuttle. But they, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn seven heroes: Michael Smith, Dick Scobee, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikulov. We mourn their loss as a nation together. The families of the seven, we cannot bear, as you do, the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much.
The president also spoke to a broader audience, particularly to students who were deeply touched at the death of the first teacher to join the astronaut corps. And as so often, he linked individual commitment and sacrifice with his idea of America.
I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them. I've always had great faith in and respect for our space program, and what happened today does nothing to diminish it. We don't hide our space program. We don't keep secrets and cover things up. We do it all up front and in public. That's the way freedom is, and we wouldn't change it for a minute. We'll continue our quest in space. There will be more shuttle flights and more shuttle crews, and yes, more volunteers, more civilians, more teachers in space. Nothing ends here. Our hopes and our journeys continue.
The force of President Reagan's speech, the effectiveness of his ability to communicate, also served him well in dealing with the inevitable political difficulties of serving as a president for 8 years. Caught in the deepening Iran-Contra scandal in late 1986, Mr. Reagan succinctly defined the situation his administration faced and staked his position.
The charge has been made that the United States has shipped weapons to Iran as ransom payment for the release of American hostages in Lebanon, that the United States undercut its allies and secretly violated American policy against trafficking with terrorists. Those charges are utterly false.
And just a few days later, still on the same subject, Mr. Reagan adjusted his tone as he again worked to massage public perception of Iran-Contra.
I'm speaking to you today from Camp David, and because the atmosphere here is a bit more informal than everyday Washington, I thought it would be a good opportunity to think and reflect with you about those crucial foreign policy matters so much in the news lately. It's also a chance to do something I've wanted to do throughout the course of these events, and that share some personal thoughts with you, to speak to you, the American people, from the heart.
Having established a comfortable, at-home tone, the president presented his case with words that took his voice and his credibility into homes across the country.
I realize you must be disappointed and probably confused with all the furore of the last couple of weeks. You must be asking, what were we doing in the Middle East? What was our policy? Where was it wrong? Were we engaged in some kind of shenanigans that blew up in our face? I can understand if these are the questions you're asking, and I'd like to provide some answers. First of all, the Middle East is critically important to our nation's security. Right now, it's a major trouble spot that could easily set off the sparks of a wider conflict. Much of our effort has been aimed at stopping terrorism, putting an end to the bombing of innocent civilians and the kidnapping of hostages, especially our own citizens, and bringing about an end to the bloody war between Iran and Iraq. When word came to me that individuals in Iran, including some members of the government there, had asked through an intermediary in a third country for a meeting with a representative of our government, I said yes. And even though these were responsible elements in Iran that might be able to assist us in stopping the violence and possibly helping us get back the hostages being held in Lebanon, there was a risk involved. But I believed then, and believe now, there was a greater risk in doing nothing, of not trying. So I gave the order to proceed. We had some notable success. There was some reduction in terrorism, and three of our hostages were released, one at a time, and others were about to follow. Then someone in the government of Iran leaked information about our contacts with Iran to a newspaper in Lebanon. You know the rest. This effort to establish a relationship with responsible moderates in Iran came to light and was broken off. But I think you can see the purposes behind our policy: to end the war in the Middle East, to prevent Soviet expansionism, to halt terrorism, and to help gain release of American hostages.
While the crisis in the Middle East, or struggles to deal with Iran or other troublesome foreign states, demanded the president's attention through his two terms in office, for Ronald Reagan, there was always a single dominant issue on the international scene, a single objective to be achieved. More than anything else, he wanted to see the end of communism, the destruction of the Soviet Union, what he called the evil empire. His most memorable remarks on the conflict with communism came on June 12, 1987, at the Brandenburg Gate in what was then West Berlin, in a still-divided Germany. Mr. Reagan quoted a phrase by the president of West Germany to define the challenge.
The German question is open as long as the Brandenburg Gate is closed. Today I say, as long as this gate is closed, as long as this scar of a wall is permitted to stand, it is not the German question alone that remains open, but the question of freedom for all mankind.
And he questioned possible indications from Moscow that the West was prevailing in the Cold War.
Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state? Or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it?
But Mr. Reagan also used the occasion to encourage Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to pursue reforms and to free a world trapped behind the Iron Curtain.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
And with hallmark timing, President Reagan defined his objective.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The Berlin Wall came down. The Soviet Union fell. And as Ronald Reagan lived out the last years of his life, lost to a disease that stole his ability to communicate, former Soviet bloc nations joined Western economic and military alliances. He was losing the battle for his life, but the nation Ronald Reagan led for 8 years was winning the Cold War he so vigorously fought. In his farewell address to the nation, delivered from the Oval Office on January 11, 1989, Mr. Reagan looked to his own and the nation's past, and he saw great images of a country that he had so often defined.
I've spoken of the Shining City all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. And how stands the city on this winter night? More prosperous, more secure, and happier than it was 8 years ago. But more than that, after 200 years, two centuries, she still stands strong and true on the Granite Ridge, and her glow is held steady no matter what storm.
Ronald Reagan's most memorable speeches can be heard at npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Weekend Edition Sunday is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can hear any story from today's show or previous shows online at npr.org. Just click on Audio Archives. This is NPR.